Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am one of your co-hosts, Shatranjay Maul. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Shelley Chan about her book, Diaspora's Homeland, Modern China in the Age of Global Migration, which was published by Duke University Press in 2018. Professor Chan is an associate professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Welcome to the podcast, Shelley. Our first question is always biographical, so I'd like to ask you about your background. Where did you grow up, and how did you become a historian of modern China and East Asia?
Sure. Thank you, Sharanjay. So I'm happy to talk about this. The question of my background and upbringing, that sort of thing, is always hard to answer, but I guess I can try my best. I've been an immigrant my whole life. I was born and raised in Hong Kong. I've lived in Canada and the U.S. for as long as a period of time as I was in Hong Kong now. So I guess my life has been about the experiences of moving around a lot. And how did I become a historian of China and East Asia? I think it's not a straight line. It was slowly figuring out, you know, what I wanted to do with my life and what my interests are. And I had other jobs before deciding to go to grad school. It all happened in Vancouver, and slowly then I decided to pursue a PhD program at UC Santa Cruz, and then the journey then continue from there.
Thank you for sharing that. I can imagine how your own experience as a migrant maybe got you interested in writing about the history of Chinese migration. I would like to ask you about this book, Diaspora's Homeland. So it is a deeply fascinating transnational history of China. So how did you come to write this book, and what do you see as its main arguments and contributions?
As is the same for many authors of their first academic books, mine was also one that was based on my PhD dissertation. But I've also done a lot of work and research and thinking after dissertation. So the book is somewhat based on a previous version, but then of a dissertation. But then I also had a chance to think it, kind of recast it in a larger kind of chronology of the age of global migration that had been identified by historians such as Adam McEwen, who's writing about it, where he argues that Chinese migration should be seen as a global phenomenon, just as other kinds of cultural migration at the time. So, The age of global migration is definitely something that I was engaging with a lot more than when I was a graduate student. And to see China through it and the Chinese diaspora and how they interacted with each other became sort of the focus of the book. And the central question that I asked was about how Chinese mass migration, which was about 20 million people moving around at the time, how did that change China? So that central question sort of drives the framework of the book, the argument of the book. And so for me to be looking back on it, it became sort of a different creature than what it was as a dissertation.
Thank you. I noticed as I was looking over your book, you mentioned that, you know, like just like the European migration of millions of people, like the Chinese migration was one of these big phenomena. But it's sort of, you know, like something that sort of maybe not in our imagination as much. The point you make about like Chinese migration as being part of that global migration, I think that's a major contribution of your book. So thank you for that. So could you tell us a little bit about the research process? Like what sorts of sources did you use? What archives did you visit? And what was it like to research for the book?
Sources are pretty conventional, actually. So there are state archives in China. I also did part of the library research in Taiwan. I used some of the, you know, British parliamentary papers that's available online for part of the book, newspapers, so on and so forth. So in terms of sources, I would say it's pretty conventional, but then I was trying to connect these sources in different locations and try to make a cohesive argument about that. So I think that the project is probably characterized by these multi-sided kind of research. I think the challenge is trying to bring them together.
Thank you. I think that's something I really appreciated about your book, that you sort of cast like a wide net and you use sources from like multiple sites. So I think that's sort of I see as something that I really liked about your book, as a major strength of your book. So reflecting on the title of the book and the introduction, it becomes apparent to me that diaspora and homeland are not naturally existing categories, but rather that these categories are co-created by various dynamics. And in this regard, you introduce these concepts of diaspora time and diaspora moment. So could you tell us about both of these concepts and also more generally about the concept of diaspora as you use it in your book?
Sure. I think, you know, kind of what I found is that, like you said, the definitions of diaspora and homeland, they are inherently unstable. And I think it is the relationship and the constantly changing shapes and forms of diaspora and homeland that fascinate me. So in my book, I have been able to show how diaspora was sometimes consisting of returnees, or sometimes very rich people, sometimes intellectuals, colonial intellectuals, or they are the face of it was actually the women who were in left behind villages. So the many faces of the Chinese diaspora is actually one of its main characteristics. And the homeland is in question here in my book, also changed throughout this century of time that I'm tracking from the mid-19th to the mid-20th century. So is the kind of changeability of these two things that you know kind of point out to me that is the relationship that is quite promising in as a window onto larger historical forces and dynamics that shape China. So I think also another thing about diaspora and the Chinese experience is that it was really, you know, to talk about it in Chinese terms, the word Huaqiao was not invented until the late 19th century. So it gives to us a specific historicity of this relationship as well, that it became a source of wealth or power, opportunity for the Chinese state. That was information itself was something new and characteristic of the modern era. So I think a combination of all these things, you know, kind of drew my attention to how diaspora functioned in Chinese history and how much it can tell us about Chinese history, the formation of China in a global system. And that diaspora itself has been approached quite broadly as a spatial concept, as a collection of dispersed communities. In thinking it through Chinese history, I think I've learned that diaspora could also be understood as a temporal phenomenon, a set of fragmented temporalities that it was constantly being adapted to or subordinated to national time. So I think there is that the spatial dimension is interesting and is often have had more attention. The temporal dimension of diaspora, that it's possible to talk about diaspora time, diaspora moments. It's also a way to recognize diaspora as a historical force is transformative, it's not derivative. And it's the kind of the ways that it sometimes resist national chronology, national territory, that you know, that really interests me.
Thank you. I think that's something that really stood out to me about your book is about the shift from just thinking about diaspora or like migration just in terms of space to thinking about it in terms of time or temporality. So I think this is a very valuable concept that maybe other scholars can build on in studying different migratory flows. So I'd like to now go into the chapters of the book, because you investigate or you sort of present like different diaspora moments. So in chapter one, you explored the diaspora moment of the late 19th century lifting of the ban on overseas emigration by the Qing dynasty authorities, and you offer a reinterpretation of this imperial edict. How do you sort of think about this moment differently, maybe from other historians? And how did China and Chinese migration change during this period? Why is this an especially notable diaspora moment in the constituting of China within the modern international order?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. I think what I try to do in that opening chapter is to revisit something that has been misunderstood, which is the 1893 lifting of the ban on Chinese emigration was often, thought of as something rather late and inconsequential move that was taken by the Qing state to finally recognize the value of Chinese emigration. So I surprisingly, when I went to look at the documents that actually or the memorials that were submitted in regard to that, was that it was actually a kind of a a proclamation to welcome return migration of Chinese that has settled abroad. And the memorial also that was submitted by this Chinese official also talks about a kind of a trajectory that led him to this request he's made to the court. And that is, you know, the whole kind of sweep of changes that happened from the middle of the 19th century with the Opium Wars, and especially with the indentured labor trade that the Qing state had to deal with. And so I brought to me the importance of coolie migration, right? Mm-hmm. And I use that with the quote unquote coolie. And there's a huge literature on indentured coolie migration, especially about how they shaped the US and the Caribbean, Cuba, Peru, particularly. So, and that had to do with discussions, conversation about slavery. And I think not a lot of that was actually brought to bear on modern Chinese history. So once again, if we turn the kind of analytical lens back onto China, asking how Chinese migration changed China instead of just changing the places that migration touched, then we are able to kind of open the door to get this restructuring that China itself politically was going through, and that is to have to deal with indentured migration, the abuses of the trade, the exploitation, and the urgent needs to control it. And so it ushered in a whole set of conceptions and relationships that the Qing state had to navigate with the treaty system, with its own still at the time operating tribute system. So I think I used that as a kind of a moment to look at how the diaspora, if at this time it looked like it was the coolie migration that was asserting its prominence and or at least the urgency to address, then it created a crisis where the Qing state had to respond and had to find a way to control it. So that to me was the perfect example of how, you know, that might be one of the earliest diaspora moments that had to do with workers, laborers, rather than mm-hmm. merchants, which dominated the scholarship on Chinese migration. So all of that, I think I was trying to make an intervention into kind of dominant ways in which coolie migration was studied, all that Chinese migration itself was studied. So to bring together labor, international relations, the Qing state's own evolution in the international system. So what's the purpose of that chapter?
Thank you for that. A follow-up thought or question that I had was this coolie migration like different from the kinds of migration that had occurred from southern China before the 19th century?
Mm-hmm. I have to acknowledge that there are other streams of indenture labor mm-hmm. Migration, especially to the Dutch East Indies at the time. But it was the coolie migration that's going to Latin America that has caught most of our attention. And also, of course, the coolie migration from South Asia mm-hmm. was also another important phenomenon. So they all happened around the same time. But to the Qing state, it appeared to me from, you know, these documents that I was reading, that it was Latin America and then the international relations that it had to deal with Cuba and Peru that caught most of their, you know, energies and attention.
Thank you for that. I think that the lens of migration sort of provides a different orientation to thinking about how Qing China had to deal with the coming of Euro-American powers and the coming of the global mm-hmm. capitalist system at that time. I definitely see the significance of this chapter of your book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also perhaps I was listening to you, to your response, is that it was kind of the discussion around indentured Chinese labor was kind of on the coattails of slavery of, mm-hmm. of African peoples, enslavement of African peoples, and a subsequent slowing down of that trade. So because of that, it also caught a lot more international attention because Chinese and I say South Asian indentured labor also was brought in to replace African mm-hmm. slaves. Mm-hmm. So in that way, then the international press became, kind of really engaged and really involved in commenting on this new phenomenon. So in a way, it was not just the efforts of the Qing Chinese state, but other players on this international stage and the kind of attention that was kind of uneven across the board that made the Chinese labor migration, indentured coolie migration, a far more important issue than some of the other phenomena and places.
Thank you. So in chapter two, you turn your attention to some of these scholars at Shanghai's Jinan University. And what sort of interested me was that they sort of drew on colonial, like Western and Japanese colonial discourses and sort of saw Chinese mm-hmm. immigrant communities in Southeast Asia as part of an imagined Chinese colonial empire. So could you tell us a little bit about these scholars and why you consider this to be another diaspora moment?
Yeah, I think most importantly, I wanted to show that the attention that was given to Chinese in the South Seas, Nanyang, was built on a kind of awareness of Japan, and its mm-hmm. imperial ambitions in Asia. So these intellectuals that I'm studying that produce a vast amount of knowledge about Chinese in colonial Southeast Asia, they were educated in Japan. They identify with a lot of the colonial categories and conceptions of understanding of frontiers of and oceanic spaces as pretty much empty and waiting for exploitation and exploration. All of that, they were taking it from Japanese concepts and Japanese studies of Chinese in the South Seas. So there's a very close relationship, I think, between these intellectuals who were sponsored by the KMT state to study the Chinese in the South Seas, as with their own backgrounds of being educated and being so in conversant with Japanese colonial knowledge, as well as European colonial knowledge about migration, about these tropical areas that shape their view of, the sort of advice and insights they could they are drawing for on behalf of the Chinese state in Nanjing. So I think in this particular diaspora moment, as I call it, it opens up another world, like kind of the intellectual universe that was also shaping the way Chinese state intellectuals were looking at these Chinese settlements, some of them, to see them as part of this unfulfilled, incomplete empire that China did not have. So So, but in a way, it was so important for to its future status as a nation state. So, so that's kind of a diaspora moment in which it inspired certain types of colonially based settler colonialism ideologies that was kind of, you know, emanating from all that interest in publication activities and intellectual research about the Chinese in colonial Southeast Asia.
That's very intriguing to hear that a lot of aspects of modernity in China sort of came mediated through Japan, that this was another sort of discourse, like the colonial discourse or settler colonial discourse, that was something else that was sort of came to these Chinese intellectuals through the example of Japan. Like that's really fascinating.
It really, none of this developed, kind of in a vacuum, that in isolation of just how China looked at Chinese settlements in Southeast Asia, but really, they were drawing on other types of knowledge that was circulating and was very active, very dominant in the region. So that's an example of also how an interest in diaspora was also an interest in China's place in the region and in the broader world.
Thank you. So in the next chapter, you pay attention to a member of the Chinese diaspora, to a British-educated Chinese Singaporean named Lim Boon Keng, who served as president of Amoy University and someone who was like dedicated to the revival of Confucianism. And he was someone who got into conflict with the Chinese writer Lu Xun. So could you tell us about this individual, his life and career, his ideas, and how you think of his career as sort of another diaspora moment?
Yes, of course. I think, he is definitely claimed in very recent decades to be a Singaporean, but I think I was trying to look at him as a colonial intellectual and a creolized intellectual, kind of a group that was part of what's known as the Baba in the Malay world, that they came from a genealogy of Chinese Malay intermarriages. A lot of them had close ties with the colonial state. They were groomed as part of the elite, and they went to prestigious educational institutions at the UK. But their ambitions were also kind of frustrated by the fact that they were not valued in the way that they felt deserved in the colonial places like Singapore or the Strait settlements. So China became a field of opportunity to a lot of these individuals who were given opportunities to rise very high and sort of as an intellectual, but also came up against, racism and other types of colonial condition that marked them as inferior in a racial hierarchy. So there's plenty of examples, say, from China from the US, for example, of, kind of local born generation of Japanese or Chinese ancestry were similarly facing the kind of limitations that they encountered, right, as racialized individuals. So here's a different example, kind of from the part of the Strait settlements. And so I think this is also a kind of a revisiting of an episode that's also been well written and well explored in the scholarship about Lim's clash with Lu Xun. it became one of the legends that's often talked about. And I think my goal there is not to just to rehash the debates of somebody encountering kind of May 4th radicalism as embodied in Lu Xun, but also to kind of highlight Lim's own colonial subjectivity that shaped his outlook on his participation in China's modernization. So, and then another way to look at it is that because there's so many Confucian revivalisms, you know, in the course of Chinese history, one could start very, very early from, say, the Song Dynasty, and it had been continuous since that there have been many kinds of Confucianisms. And so a diasporic kind looks like, you know, the kind that I was writing about this chapter. So I think it belongs to part of that conversation of a kind of Confucian revivalisms as one that came from abroad also. So I was trying to address that with kind of as also part of a kind of great interest in religions in a colonial setting in Southeast Asia, that his interest in Confucianism was not just to be interpreted through May 4th radicalism, but also through, you know, something that's rooted in a colonial setting in Southeast Asia that defined Confucianism as a type of religion, and he's also reacting and resisting that. So I guess in a nutshell, there's just a lot to be said if we about Lim, even though we seem to know a lot about him already, that that the very fact of his colonial background shaped the way he thought about China, and that should be taken more seriously and simply as just someone who becoming attached to China almost because of his ethnicity. So I think I'm trying to move away from that.
Thank you. That's a really fascinating to think about. Like, I mean, I think other scholars are also looking at the lens of religion and sort of how like diasporic Chinese might have an influence on religion in China. So I mean, this is very fascinating to hear about Lim and about the reinterpretation that you offer about his life and career and his effort at diasporic Confucian revivalism. So in the next chapter, you turn your attention to gender and to women and to the women who are left behind. And this is also sort of at a different moment in history when the People's Republic of China was established. So how was the Communist Party state in its early years in the 1950s? How was it influenced by the impact of mass migration? And what does this tell us about the early years of the People's Republic of China? Now, how does focusing on women help us think about Chinese migration?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the radical transformations that the early PRC state sought to bring to China was an interesting moment to look at, because then in so many different kinds of scholarship, we've seen, you know, how they encounter the reality on the ground and how they then had to adapt to it, of the things that they had not thought about. And China was really a big place. And at this time, trying to liberate and incorporate South China into its territory brought a similar kind of challenges and difficulties like it was elsewhere. So in these places, they're both urban and rural. Migration was a fact of life that, you know, one in every 5 to 6 families in the province of Guangdong had someone who's abroad. And so it really was something that permeated you know, kind of the living a kind of transnational life where you deeply connected with someone far away. And they might send some money home, or they might not even be able to do so. But then living in a place where for these women, they might be the heads of the households. They might have to contend with some of the shortfalls of remittances that they were expecting from their husbands. That sort of thing, you know, characterized life. And then how the villages were organized around this phenomenon was something that was very interesting and deeply troubling to the Communist Party state that was trying to incorporate this area into its own larger vision of socialist construction, that you have such a kind of a gendered reality where you have lots of women that were, you know, sort of looked like they were abandoned, looked like they never did anything productive in their lives and just waiting to be supported by, you know, money sent home from men abroad. And also the fact that some of the families looked like they were much better off than others, and none of them really pursued farming as their main household economic activity. So all of that came up against and quite opposite to the kind of rural imaginary or the division of labor or the conjugal family, you know, as a preferred kind of modern form of family. All of that seemed to mark this area as so deviant and extreme and had to be reformed so that some sort of productivity and gender equality could be guaranteed. So I really enjoyed writing this chapter about this village is filled with women who looked like they were really sad and trapped in these marriages and the effort by the state to want to rescue them, that, you know, created, you know, a lot of conflicts and consequences that the state was not expecting. You know, they had not expected some of these women would actually then go divorce their husbands, you know, kind of in a moment's notice. And that upset the local dynamics where you have local officials and mothers-in-laws, you know, very upset by all of these, you know, kind of changes. And then also, you know, these women were then told to also strive for or try to bring, you know, have their husbands bring more income, more remittances, so that they could contribute those to state projects. And that really backfired. So I think in a way that the state was at the beginning pretty clueless about, you know, kind of local reality, and their interventions created, you know, lots of conflicts and tensions. And then the chapter that I was following is you know, also a kind of interrelated phenomenon. It's also about the same area, but then you have a return phenomenon of people who were fleeing anti-Chinese movements in Southeast Asia, and some of them are quite wealthy, some of them were not at all. And so the state was also scrambling to help them, resettle them, and turn them into socialist subjects. But on the premise that these people were politically suspect and there needs to be a process to reintegrate them. And so the speed and format of which it should happen becomes a source of great anxieties. And as China itself was changing rapidly during the 50s and 60s, you know, the act of balancing between all of these agendas becomes more and more difficult. So to me, these two chapters were also good examples of showing how the diaspora was kind of creating tensions and crises and, opportunities to act for the state that itself was going through a lot of change. So in similar ways as in the previous chapters, they show me they are a window, a portal to understand how the nation is trying to assimilate all these different temporalities and spatialities brought by a diaspora itself has many facets, lots of contradictions within it. And so the balancing act becomes the kind of the thread of all my chapters.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the points you make in your book is that the lens of diaspora helps to think of Chinese history as being more fragmented and more multifaceted or multi-layered. So, I mean, the stories of these women and the story of the Chinese communist state sort of challenges with sort of incorporating the southern Chinese regions within the People's Republic of China, like and within their project of socialism, this sort of really brings home that point. And as you also answered what was going to be my next question about the Guiqiao or the returned overseas Chinese migrants and sort of the People's Republic of their movement back from anti-Chinese and anti-Chinese pogroms and so on back to China. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. And I think you're absolutely right just now about all these, kind of different elements the returnees themselves was a very heterogeneous group socially and economically, and so it's also really confounding to the state about how to deal with them, and so instead of marking them as or giving them the sort of class label that they were giving everybody domestically, they were somewhat segregated, isolated as this group that all came from abroad, no matter who they are, what their backgrounds were. So to consolidate their resources and their attentions, I guess. But slowly they discover, because of the different types of resources they require of the state are quite different. The poorer ones were put on farms where they were asked to become farmers. And a lot of these people came from urban areas and never had any agricultural experience. And it came, as a huge disappointment to these people because they were expecting, to be treated a lot better instead of being asked to produce their own food, for example. And then there's this other group that has received much better treatment on the service where they were invited to buy private housing in a socialist country, that they were given a set of privileges, that nonetheless is contingent, that also kind of made them, kind of pretty precarious at a time when high socialism happened, and that they looked like that they were a kind of holdover group who were enjoying all these privileges and living in such luxurious conditions to be a kind of threat that that would contaminate China, the rest of China as well. So the different kinds of treatments show to me, you know, kind of the different stages of socialism that was happening. And then also how a diaspora returnee group were constantly in the middle of it, that they were marked off as not quite domestic. They were identified as groups that came from abroad and would require a certain process of re-education, reform, reintegration. But it only worked when, you know, the state was willing to accommodate any kind of differences or complications that bring when you try to incorporate different groups and different pieces of socialism and be willing to stay flexible. So once that flexibility and willingness to accommodate is gone and evaporated by the time of high socialism, that everyone was urged to become socialists right now, that these groups that had been marked off and had been singled out were then the ones that would suffer the most.
Thank you. Actually, I have a follow-up question related to that. Did some of these returnees or did the Chinese migrant networks, did they have any influence or did they in any way shape China's transition from Maoist socialism to what we call like socialism with Chinese characteristics or neoliberalism or capitalism?
Sure. I think even in the early 1950s, I think the diaspora was very much welcomed and seen as a positive force that could help China's construction of socialism. Mm-hmm. So I think that it really, this you trace that relationship really show you actually something that China itself was going through, right? Instead of what the diaspora itself was kind of being this recalcitrant actor. So that really go through a phase of kind of like some openness and some willingness to accommodate. And then, when socialism kicked into high gear, that room to negotiate disappeared. And so when high socialism came back down, we see another phase of the relationship. And that really had to do with China's transformations. That, you know, once again, you know, the diaspora was seen as a kind of resource rather than a threat. So I think that gives us another way to look at that relationship, and then also the reconnections that the diaspora participated. Also, kind of, it has been quite historical that it had happened before. It seems like sometimes we're moving on a spectrum rather than just kind of going from one kind of change to another without any type of pattern. So I think, you know, studying diaspora gives us a way to think long historically and also interregionally. Mm-hmm. So even though I think you can also do diaspora in very focused and delimited ways that is enlightening, but I think the book chooses to go in a direction where it wants to show something broad and not just relevant to small parts of China or small groups of Chinese people, but it's really a method to think in long historical, large scale terms and to bring these large scale processes to light. So I think, it's really challenging to write a book that covers a long period of time, like more than a century. And also not to limit myself to any location. I I need to then learn about, but actually focus on the issue and the conflict or the crisis. So I think the book has kind of, in a way, dragged me to places that then I discover I have to know something about. And that has been both laborious, but also rewarding.
Thank you. So in the conclusion, you reflect on the substantial changes in China since the 1970s, as the country has reopened to the world and to the global capitalist system, and it's been restructured by neoliberalism. And you have like new flows of Chinese migration to all parts of the world from the People's Republic of China in the last 30 to 40 years. So can we consider this to be another diaspora moment?
Yeah, I think there is that possibility. So I think offering, you know, kind of the concept as a possibility to be explored. So I've only kind of observed some of the changes and more recently with Chinese migration and try to read as much as possible. But I think, you know, but I have not written and do serious research about it, but so in a way I'm trying to be more suggestive in my conclusion and saying that it could potentially be a way for us to think about these broad changes and broad connections that intersects with other kinds of temporalities and spatialities. Mm-hmm. So that's something I try to kind of convey and also just leave it out as a possibility for others to look at.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think in your conclusion, you sort of indicate or you open up avenues for future scholars of Chinese migration to explore, because I think this is something that it's still evolving now with new flows of migration, for example, from Hong Kong. And you know, like the dynamics amongst the People's Republic of China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Chinese migrant communities. We'll have to see how it sort of evolves in the future. But hopefully, other scholars can build on your book to research and write on these topics.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think. The part where I kind of gesture toward China, Hong Kong, Taiwan is to, I guess, call attention to migration as this one kind of connection we can think about when it comes of, you know, these three places. Do they, you know, does it make sense to actually consider them as one connected phenomenon? And I think the history and legacies of migration could be one of the examples that there were flows between these places. And like you said, you know, kind of the current maybe attention to the Hong Kong diaspora, mm-hmm. is also then signals possibly another diaspora moment where you know, previously it received no attention and people do not identify necessarily with themselves being part of a Hong Kong diaspora, but suddenly it's been in the news. So I think it then has some similarities to how I see diaspora, where it's not constantly active. It disappears, reappears. And when it appears, then it offers us an opportunity to look at what is happening, where were some of these conflicts and fault lines that mm-hmm. were not visible and now becoming really visible and really contentious. So it's quite true. You know, if you take the example of the Hong Kong diaspora that, you know, kind of just back a few years ago, nobody was actually talking about it or mm-hmm. bringing it up. So I think there is something there And even though, it may not make sense to always talk of a Chinese diaspora, certainly that does not exist as a singular phenomenon. But, talking about Chinese identity in diasporic ways is then to recognize how a Chinese identity is sometimes unified and sometimes really falling apart. Mm-hmm. And it makes more sense to then talk about a Taiwan diaspora, a Hong Kong diaspora, or a Hakka diaspora, Hokkien diaspora, Cantonese diaspora. So I think it's that dynamic of integration, disintegration that really stands out. And I think it merits our analysis.
Thank you. Another thought I had about that was that even we shouldn't think of like Chinese diaspora or Chinese immigrants as sort of homogeneous or sort of cohesive entity, because there are so many different tensions, there's so many different like disagreements that might exist, for example, about whether it is like those who are in favor of the People's Republic of China and those who might be like critical of it and so on. And like these tensions will probably keep existing wherever the Chinese immigrant community exists. And of course, as you mentioned, like there's so many different subgroups or different groups who might not see things the same way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in general, we tend to define a diaspora by their ethnicity, and it contains its own problems. It's the same way we could say China is a huge place too. Is it doesn't make sense to talk of a single China? Mm-hmm. So sometimes it does, sometimes lots of times it doesn't. And I think we should apply the same wisdom to diaspora as well, that what should be central to our understanding is of its plurality and multi kind of layeredness, and there have been many waves of migration, and then also it's about positionality rather than ethnicity, to be situated outside of an imagined or real homeland marks the condition of diaspora. And that recognition is not always there or always necessary. So I think being very sensitive to these things temporally and spatially makes a lot of difference. But it still remains a very useful device, I think, as a category of analysis to think about integration, disintegration, broad transformations that's long historical and also cross-regional, intercultural. So to me, diaspora is a tool that we should learn to use wisely and intelligently, to not flatten the differences and contradictions within it. As a lens to help us see better.
Thank you. And thank you so much, Shelley, for taking so much time to talk to me today about your book. So before we end, I wanted to ask you, what are you working on right now?
Yeah, I'm working on a new project about the Nanyang. So it actually grew out of chapter 2 of my book. And as I was researching and writing about it, I discovered this still a lot more than intellectual discourses about the Nanyang. And I got interested in the kind of the existence of the Nanyang as a lived place, as a real place that, mm-hmm. that does not only exist in books, but people would say, you know, they're going to Nanyang, they're coming back from Nanyang, or they're living in the Nanyang. Mm-hmm. So it became very interesting to me, you know, what did they mean actually? And also to kind of push against the grain of how we normally like to translate the Nanyang into Southeast Asia. So ironically turning a sea region into a landmass. So what got lost if we do that as a shorthand that the Nanyang is Southeast Asia, and so the maritime and diasporic aspects of this social geography is the kind of the what's motivating me now in kind of trying to explain its rise as a region, and it's also its disappearance in the second half of the 20th century, where the Nanyang got replaced by Southeast Asia as a spatial category that was supposed to be part of a different world order. So I'm looking at sort of the rise and disappearance of the Nanyang as this dynamic region, economically, socially, and politically. There's so many things that called the Nanyang. They had the word on the name Nanyang in the titles or in businesses or schools, universities, products, tobacco, for example, cultural aesthetics. Even there was once a Nanyang Communist Party. So I'm investigating and kind of looking at how diaspora the Nanyang came to symbolize a whole range of social meanings and contradictions. So as a way to bring together China and Southeast Asia in a trans-regional frame. So to explain, I guess, in simple terms, explain China and Southeast Asia through the rise of Nanyang.
Thank you so much. That sounds like a really fascinating project. And I look forward to reading more about it. So thank you again, and I hope you have a good evening.
Thank you, Sharon Jay. I enjoyed this very much.
Thanks. Thank you.